Party, the podcast, co-hosted by the Governance Program at the Aga Khan University and
the International Society for Islamic Legal Studies, in cooperation with the University of Bern.
Welcome to Shara'i, the podcast. My name is Gianluca Parolin.
And my name is Serena Tolino, and we are here today with Delfina Serrano, tenured researcher at the Spanish Higher Council for Scientific Research in Madrid. Welcome, Delfina.
Thank you.
Delfina, you are a member of the board of ISILS. When did your association with ISILS begin?
Well, I attended the second conference, which at that time was called the Joseph Schacht Conference. Maribel Fierro organized the Joseph Schacht Conference in Granada, and she invited me or suggested me to present a proposal. So this was my first Joseph Schacht ISILS conference. And then, well, I missed the coming ones, but I think since the second conference held at Harvard in, I don't remember the year, I've attended and participated, presented papers at all the subsequent conferences, and hopefully I will also attend the Londres one.
We expect you. We will have the opportunity to look into one of your latest fascinating article later in the episode. But what do you do when you don't do research? Do you have a hobby?
Yes, well, I like reading, I like traveling a lot. I like going to restaurants, the cinema, to the theater. But I think the activity that I enjoy at most is hiking. And hiking because of the advantages for the body, but also for spirit. And while I hike, I get ideas. Sometimes we are blocked. We don't know how to continue with a paper or what to do with this and that. And hiking is, I mean, the best thing, and I recommend it to everybody, the best thing to unblock and to see how to proceed further, of course, regarding academic and scholarly issues, but also at a personal level. And it's also very healthy. It's good for storing vitamin D, etc. So it's something I try to do in the city, in Madrid. Madrid is a very big city, and the advantage of such big cities is that you, every time you go out, you discover something you had not seen before, or a place where you had never been before, or a new museum, restaurant, whatever. So it's because I don't live in the center. So every time I go to downtown Madrid to walk, I enjoy it. It's stimulating because there is always something new coming up.
Do you have a favorite place where you like to go hiking?
Well, I like beaches. Well, I just, on the beach, I don't hike. I just walk. I like the mountains, of course. And in general, whatever nice landscape are at my disposal. But I also like parks in cities. I have some very nice parks close from my place where you can experience semi-wild nature. So, yes, I'm very open. I mean, I'm not very demanding, and I have hiked in wonderful places.
Looking at the gray zone between work and hobbies, you have attended a number of ISILS conferences. Is there anything specific about the ISILS conferences that you particularly like? Any specific aspects?
I should say, listening to others' papers and to getting to know about others' research. But to be sincere, and I think many other people share this preference of mine, what I like is the social part. The opportunity to meet, I mean, I have made very nice relations with colleagues after attending ISILS conferences, and this is something, I mean, I attach a lot of importance to ICILS and to attending every ICILS conference. No, I think it's the most important conference for me, and for this reason I have tried to be quite constant. And I have always strived to present a proposal and to adapt to the different focus of every conference. So it's the social part. As I said, my first ICILS conference was that held in Granada, wonderfully organized by Maribel Fierro. And well, I remember, I will not say his name, but I remember having breakfast with a very renowned specialist in Islamic law. We didn't talk about Islamic law. We just talked about personal things, about our families, about our hobbies, etc. And this is one of my nicest memories, the opportunity to get to know and to have at your reach these great figures of Islamic legal studies, and also the younger colleagues. Well, at that time I was very young, now I'm not I'm not that young, but yes, meeting colleagues I've met during the last conferences, and yes, and sharing, because I think this personal contact also encourages research and real interesting academic exchange and ideas about future conferences, etc. Well, let's say the social part.
Is there some specific that you would like to see in the 10th ICILS conference that will take place in London?
Well, I must say I was very satisfied with past conferences. Maybe something I've missed was the opportunity to have the papers published together. I know this is difficult from a logistic point of view, and even more so when the conferences are not devoted to a specific topic, as will be the case of the next the London conference. But I remember, for example, after the second Harvard conference to which I attended, a group of participants organized among ourselves and had our papers published together by HAWA, the Brill Journal on Gender. And well, I would like, if not an opportunity provided by the board or by the organizers, to have all the papers published together, at least more effort to have, which of course this is a task I charge on myself, to have little clusters of papers published together. Apart from that, I'm very much looking forward to this conference, and I have no other expectations.
We are going to take your word on this, Delfina. Recently, in 2018, you published a very interesting article in the Journal of Middle East Women's Studies titled Redefining Paternal Filiation Through DNA Testing, in which you sort of transitioned from pre-modern to contemporary jurisprudence. And I was wondering if you could share with us a bit of a background of this journey for you as a researcher.
Well, I had tried to transition from the pre-modern to the contemporary period before. I did it regarding gender issues, no? Islamic law and gender, Islamic law and violence, etc. I thought, since I am a public servant, I feel as an Islamologist and as an Arabist, I feel that, and since Sharia has such a bad press, but everybody talks about Sharia and everybody thinks that to know something about Sharia, to have something to say about Sharia, I thought it was necessary first to show that the kind of research people like me do on this very apparently, not for me of course, but these apparently boring texts, medieval texts and difficult texts, I felt I was obliged to show people, the regular taxpayers, that this is interesting for them too. Of course, I believe in the intrinsic interest of primary research. I mean, this shouldn't be justified. We shouldn't justify the need to study the kind of the writings produced by Andalusi Muslims, for example. But, well, I think a modicum of emotional intelligence advice is to try to communicate or to try to reach the general public and show them the interest of this research for contemporary societies. And in the case of Sharia, I think, well, for all of us, this interest is obvious, but for the people, it's not. That's not the case. And I have to do that with colleagues, with other Arabists with whom I interact from Spain, with whom I interact very regularly, with colleagues from other disciplines with whom I also have very close contact. And that was the reason why I decided to pay attention, for example, to the punishment of fornication, to stoning, or to the issue of children born outside of marriage and unmarried mothers in Islamic society. Also, I am Spanish. I grew up in a Catholic family. I was raised and socialized in the Catholic religion and culture. And, well, this approach to extramarital sexual relations and to the motherhood outside of marriage, etc., the taboo that exists about these issues is not strange for me at all. I grew up, I mean, I was a teenager when Franco died, and I still remember that times, and I haven't forgotten. So there is also a personal interest in researching these kind of questions that affect women's role in societies, the monotheistic religions approach to women and to women's sexuality, etc.
What caught your attention in DNA testing then? Why do you think it's a good case study?
Well, this article is results from my participation in a research project led by Ayman Shabana from Georgetown University on how new medical technologies and biological technologies are changing or are affecting the conception of the nuclear family in Islamic societies. My interest in DNA tests comes from before that collaboration, which started in 2017, I think, because I think the possibility to establish through DNA testing the biological relationships between people undermines the argument explaining why fornication has to be punished that harshly, according to classical fiqh.
In the article, you also show the relevance of Haim al-Jawziyya minority opinion on establishing filiation for children born out of wedlock. So as a scholar, you're a scholar who worked a lot on Maliki law and worked a lot on Al-Andalus. So I wanted to ask you, how do you assess the relevance of minority and also peripheral opinions on our understanding of Islamic law?
Well, in this respect, I draw from my experience with pre-modern Islamic law. I had the opportunity to see or to realize that the fact that, as we all know, classical Islamic jurisprudence is characterized by the admission of internal divergence of opinions. Majority opinions had more authority, more prestige, and yes, sometimes judicial practice followed the majority opinions. But in other cases, judicial practice drew or followed minority opinions. It all depended on the judge, on the qadi. The qadi was entitled for all the, at least before the 15th century, rulers never managed to impose judging according to one among divergent legal opinions upon the qadis of their realm. Qadis always had the capacity to draw on a different opinion, provided he was able to substantiate his decision. And I can't say that because I paid attention to the issue of a'amal or judicial practice. A'amal is a locally and temporally limited form of consensus applying to judicial practice. I mean, the qadis of a certain place agree to issue judgment according to one among many divergent or among several divergent opinions. But they were not obliged to issue judgment according to the AMAL or according to the opinion followed by a majority of cadis or by a majority of juries. And I think nowadays the case is very similar. There are opinions that have authority because they have been issued by international fiqh organizations or by very prestigious jurists. But if you examine practice and the way to check whether these opinions, the relevance of these opinions, is to look at judicial practice, which is not easy all the time, because doing research in judicial practice in the contemporary Maghreb, for example, is not easy, at least not from Spain, and because access to the archives is not, either the archives are not, I mean, access is not simple. You have to go to the country and to, this is no guarantee that you can have access to these materials. The material is maybe not organized. It's not easy. But when you have the opportunity to trace a certain issue, for example, court decisions about paternity claims by unmarried mothers, you see that practice is not, I mean, maybe most of the cadis or of the judges issue judgment according to the established majority opinion. But there are others who don't. And these ones are the ones who take the lead for change. And also there is a symbiotic relationship between social movements and demands, even by non-influential groups of people, and the law. Because no law can survive without satisfying to a certain degree the needs of the subjects to this law. In the case of Ibn Qayyim, I found out that in Algeria, for example, the Supreme Court used this minority opinion by Ibn al-Qayyim to justify their decision to award paternity rights to a mother who denounced the biological father of her child, her baby. The problem is that this decision, which took place, it's real, but it has like disappeared. There is no interest in giving publicity to the fact that the Supreme in Algeria issued that decision, drawing on or arguing on the basis of Ibn al-Qayyim's minority opinion. For this reason, I think also our role as researchers students of Islamic law who can read Arabic, and this is very important because we can access sources and information through internet, for example, that other people, that activists, for example, other specialists from other fields cannot understand or take advantage of. I think it is important to give publicity to these minority innovative judgments by cadis, because one judgment can open change. I'm talking about the future. I'm trying to figure out how things will go in the future. But my intuition, my instinct tells me how things are going to evolve in the future, because the same or similar developments have happened in this way in the past. Also, I have also paid attention not only to judges' judgments against, for example, the demands of unmarried mothers, but the very fact that mothers more and more go to the courts and claim their rights, even if they can anticipate a negative result, is also very important. So these are the kind of things I used to pay attention to, apart from the code, the judgment, the majority opinion, etc. But I do not hide a certain bias, maybe, a certain optimistic bias. If I pay attention to these kind of things, of issues, it's because I have hope and because I am optimistic and because I am a woman.
You attach a lot of relevance to the open acknowledgement of a minority opinion like Ibn al-Qayyim's. And of course, you have already brought in the question of prestige. What do you make of that? What do you make of the open acknowledgement of a minority opinion? And do you see a difference from contemporary legal practice and the pre-modern one?
just mentioning, or I mean researching, it was not me who, I mean, I haven't worked on Ibn al-Qayyim. I just read that Ibn al-Qayyim had this alternative or minority opinion on paternity establishment or on filiation out of wedlock. In my experience, both with the pre-modern sources and the contemporary ones, is that certain minority opinions, when they did not interest the majority or those with the upper hand in society or within jurists' establishment, these opinions tended to be hidden or concealed, sometimes very subtly. I am just working or returning to one such cases concerning Kadia Yad, one of the jurists whom I have worked most. He lived in the 12th century, so he had a very innovative approach to rape, to the crime of rape, to denounces of rape. The way he uses the relevant terminology suggests that he was in favor of considering claims of rape as complaints rather than as claims. Why? Because a complaint is not subject to the hat for calumny if you cannot substantiate your claim. Because false or unfounded accusations of zina are subject to the punishment of calumny. So, through this, instead of referring to a woman's accusation of rape against a man as a claim with the verb da, idda, he uses the root shakaya in the fifth form, tashakka. He says, hiya tashakkat. But had I not read Ibn Hazm's views about this question, which he issued one century earlier, I wouldn't have realized the importance of using the one verb or the other. There is clear evidence that this nuance Kadia Yad wanted to introduce in Maliki doctrine on rape was concealed. Later jurists were not ready to accept this nuance, and it's very interesting to see how later commentators try to create the impression that no, that this terminological selection or this the difference between one verb or the other is not relevant. But it was. So these things happen, and this is why it is important to demonstrate how doctrines and opinions are manipulated within a single tradition for whatever interests, no? In this case, to make the reputation of men prevail over the need to address the crime of rape to women's satisfaction. So this is why I think it is important to insist that these opinions exist, and it is important that activists who are not Islamologists, who are not Arabists, know, because many activists have realized that in order to thwart the patriarchal view of the Sharia, it is necessary to argue with arguments drawn from the Sharia. So, well, here modestly, I think we can contribute to this activism as well, just by not letting that manipulations pass unnoticed of this kind.
Thank you a lot, Delphine, also for this reflection on our public role as scholars of Islamic law. I was wondering, where would you introduce your current research in a course outline, or where would you recommend our colleagues who are listening to this episode to introduce your research in their courses?
Well, within the broader label or tag of Islamic law and society. Or I could also feel very much at ease as someone who does history of Arabic Islamic legal texts, because this is what I do mainly. I do history of legal Arabic Islamic legal texts with all the import of the expression. I am very, very interested in terminology, not only in what jurists say, but also in how they say, how they express their opinions. This can be sometimes as important as what they say. We tend sometimes to translate certain expressions they use with very opaque terms that nobody else outside the discipline and even within understands. And well, this is very nice because it's very well. I mean, I have nothing against. But sometimes we are like over-correcting or applying categories that have to do with power dynamics within a discipline. I mean, the ones who want to distinguish themselves from the journalists or whatever. We introduce categories and nuances that are not in the source. I mean, I don't say that my translations or my interpretations of the kind of texts I read are correct or are the best, but I prefer first to preserve the literality of the terms. And then, yes, sometimes you have to find an expression or a way to translate this that is intelligible for specialists and for non-specialists. But there is a certain danger there to distort. So, yes, I insert myself within these two broad research lines, Islamic law and society and history of Islamic legal texts.
Thank you so much, Delfina, for having shared your thoughts and the reflections with us today at Sharae. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, and we hope to see you in London.
Okay, bye-bye. See you.